98 tells us that the star represents one who had acquired power and become a king. It refers to Muhammad, who commenced his preaching career in AD 609 and who 13 years later assumed regal functions at Medina with rapidly increasing power and reigned without a rival until 632. The earth in this vision speaks of those who dwell upon the earth, that is, the Roman earth or habitable. It was his mission to torment the unsealed idolaters of the Eastern Roman Empire. Brother Thomas states, the evil angel community, and that's alluding back to that verse 13 of the previous chapter, I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven. And some translators make that word evil. So he's taken up both terms, you see. The evil angel community, constituted of servants of the deity sealed in their foreheads, was not to be tormented by this woe. The sealed servants of the deity, the enlightened believers who have obeyed the truth, are nowhere in the apocalypse style of the earth. They are a holy nation. But the earth in the apocalypse is the very reverse. The earth is an unholy generation that wanders after the beast and that worships the dragon and worships the beast and represents the all kindreds and tongues and nations subject to the dragon and the beast forms of government. The earth in the prophecy of the fifth and sixth trumpets is symbolical of the secular and ecclesiastical orders and people of the Catholic apostasy, which by the fifth trumpet were to be tormented and injured, and by the sixth trumpet to be killed or deprived of all power, authority and rule over the eastern third of the Roman Empire. So I'd like you to understand that at this stage, although really Brother Thomas is jumping ahead a little bit, because this tormenting doesn't come out until another verse or so yet. The fifth trumpet deals with the torment that we're going to come upon this nation. But we must understand it is the kingdom that is being tormented. So much so that people were pleading for death. Not that they wanted to die themselves, but they would be happy for the kingdom to die so that the caliph might come in and at least give them peace. But they couldn't. Death fled from them. The kingdom wasn't able to die until the sixth trumpet. So Muhammad then, in preparation for this, was given a key or power to establish a royal dynasty out of the undistinguished multitudes of Arabs. The phrase bottomless pit is better rendered pit of the abyss. The word abyss in the Greek language is frequently used as synonymous with the sea. Compare Job 38 verse 30, Job 41 31, Isaiah 63 13 and Romans 10 7. The apocalyptic abyss is the troubled sea of nations out of which Daniel's four beasts arose. Now Arabia is both physically and politically the pit of this abyss. Physically it is identified with the geographically depressed region of Arabia, where the power of Muhammad was matured. You've got the great Arabada depression of the Jordan Valley, which goes right down through into the area of Arabia. The lowest part of the earth's surface is found in that particular area. So both geographically it was the pit of the abyss, and politically because its tribes may be regarded as the lowest or worst of the peoples of the east. I've got a note here to say a more detailed description of these terms is found in Eureka Volume 2, pages 450 to 456. I'm not going to go into it in detail at this stage. If you would like more proof that this is speaking of the area of Arabia, then you've got access to Eureka. I don't think we'll take up time in proving it at this stage. The context of the prophecy will show very clearly that it fits, but if you want to look at those terms more closely, then I suggest you read those six pages in Eureka Volume 2. Right, well, we can turn over our tapes now and then we'll go over to our note on page 102. So we'll come back then to our note, and we're going to take up the historical background on page 102, which will again revise a little bit for us but take us on a bit further. In order to get the picture then of what's going to happen historically in this section, let's look at our historical note on page 102. Muhammad, as we've already said, was born in Mecca in the year AD 570. Now, I don't think we did say he was born there in that year. We told you when he commenced his prophesying. But he was born in 570, and as we know, he died in AD 632. And between this time, or at this time, most of Arabia had fallen to his new religion of Islam. The gentle, faithful, and prematurely old Abu Bakr was appointed his successor and gave his blessing to the Jihad, or the Holy War, against Syria. Syria fell to the Mohammedan army by the year 635. Abu Bakr died after reigning only 2 years, and the vast conquests of Palestine and Mesopotamia, Egypt, Persia, Tripolitania, and Cyprus were continued under the leadership of the caliphs Omar and Osman. Gibbon, in his Decline and Fall, states, in the 10 years of the caliph Omar, the Saracens, and this becomes another name for these Mohammedan hordes, the Saracens reduced to his obedience 36,000 cities or castles, destroyed 4,000 churches or temples of the unbelievers, and erected 1,400 mosques for the exercise of the religion of Muhammad. 100 years after his flight from Mecca, the arms and reign of his successors extended from India to the Atlantic Ocean over the various and distant provinces which may be comprised under the names of Persia, Syria, Egypt, Africa, and Spain. I don't know whether we all have previously realized the extent of the Arab Empire at that time. Within 100 years, it extended from India to the Atlantic Ocean. And those are the words of Gibbon. Under the unifying banner of the Prophet, the sinewy Arab warriors burst out of their hot, dry homeland in the abyss. Behind them lay a peninsula one-third buried in sand dunes. Ahead was an irresistible lure, booty for those who lived, paradise for those who died fighting the unbeliever. One Arab historian says, the believers smote and slaughtered till the going down of the sun, and the fear of the Arabs fell upon all kings. The Catholic either renounced his religion and became Mohammedan, or fell victim to the torments of the locusts, as they are described in Revelation 9. The elected caliph came to an end in 661, and the Umayyad dynasty commenced. The converted population of non-Arabs were required to pay high taxes. This caused conflict within the empire, and this, together with internal unrest and conflicts between the Umayyads and the Abbasids, brought about the downfall of the Umayyad dynasty of caliphs in 750 AD. So there was a new dynasty of caliphs, or successors, then came up. And incidentally, if you look up this little book, the Penguin Atlas, you'll find it gives you maps of these various stages of the Arab Empire. The first caliph of the Abbasid dynasty died in 754 and was succeeded by Al-Mansur, the real founder of the Abbasids, who created the power base for the new state and built the city of Baghdad as its capital. Gradually, the caliph became an inaccessible figurehead and lost his political power until after the death of the caliph Harun al-Rashid, the empire experienced a speedy decline. Finally, in AD 936, the caliph lost his political power altogether and confined himself to the role of spiritual head of the faithful, whilst the government of the state was left to the powerful emir. Okay, back to our exposition, verse 2. And he opened the pit of the abyss, and smoke ascended out of the pit, as it were of a great furnace, and the sun was darkened, and the air from the smoke of the pit. So we come to verse 2. He opened the abyss. That is, let loose the Arabians on the Roman Empire. So here was the man that was given the key to this abyss. He was given the power to establish a world dynasty. He did this. And out of this abyss, this area of Arabia down to the south, he opened up the abyss. And the opening of the abyss was to let loose the Arabians on the Roman Empire. We're told that as a result of the opening, that there was smoke as a furnace which issued out of the abyss. Smoke represents God's wrath and judgment on the unsealed, which was manifested in the wars that ensued. And as a result of that, the sun and the air were darkened, that is, the Roman imperialism was eclipsed. So it's a little bit like a jigsaw puzzle, one might say. You get the symbols, you piece them together, and you build up the story. And so the story has involved a star falling from heaven to the earth, a key opening the abyss. When the abyss is opened, out comes smoke, and the smoke darkens the sun and the air. So what it's telling us then is that Muhammad, such as I sit down here on my high mesula, that Muhammad was the star. He fell from the heaven in Mecca. He fell unto the earth in order that judgment might be poured out upon the Roman earth. He was given power to open up the area of Arabia. Having opened it up, God's judgment poured forth from the area of Arabia in order that the sun and the air of the Roman imperialism might be darkened. Now, those are the sort of notes that, once you've got a general picture of the story, would probably be enough to summarise what verses 1 and 2 are about, but you might want to put some other a little block note down the bottom or top of the page with some of the historical facts in it. We move on then to our third verse, building up the story as we go. Verse 3 tells us that the smoke, which represents God's judgments in the general sense, issued out of this abyss, and out of the smoke there appeared locusts. The locusts represent these Arabian hordes. There's some very good pictures here in the notes about the effects of locusts. Those of us who are somewhat older in years, I don't know where old starts and finishes, but those of us who at least can remember the locust plagues of, what was it, the 1950s or 1940s or somewhere around about that period anyway, I think they came on about 3 successive occasions. They were quite devastating, weren't they, in the way in which they just descended on a person's garden or lawn or something, and an hour or so later left, and what they left was nothing. And they were quite incredible, the way they would just descend on the parklands and that sort of thing, the ovals, and absolutely devour them. Those who are younger in years won't remember that, but they can take our word for it. For those who aren't prepared to take words for things, there's 2 very good illustrations here in the notes. On page 100, there's a map there showing the desert locusts in the Middle East, and it's quite authentic. That map was produced by the CIA. That's how authentic that map is. And I do mean the Central Intelligence Agency too. It came out of a book which was produced by them, entitled Issues in the Middle East. And in fact, the picture on the right hand side also came out of that book too. So you can see the way in which the area of Arabia is very certainly associated with locust activity. In fact, you can see that really the heaviest shaded area is virtually plonk on top of Mecca and Medina, isn't it? It's the area which is covered by the grey, just the general grey area, overlapped by the 45 degree angle shading there. So that they not only develop there in spring, that is March to July, but also in the July to October period as well. And you can see this one arrow there showing the way in which that particular lot would sweep up into the area of Israel. So it's a very, very fitting description that that the Arabian tribe should be represented by locusts. And what they did, of course, would fittingly answer to what the locusts do. The locust is a fitting symbol of these Arabian tribes. Incidentally, I didn't read the notes on verse 2, but I think we've said a bit about those, and you can fill in those missing, which we missed out there. So coming to verse 3, then, we've got the symbol of the locust as a fitting symbol for these Arab hordes. In the natural sense, locusts are generated in the pits of the earth, out of which the new progeny arises in the spring. The desert area of Arabia is a favourite breeding ground for these creatures. One writer claims it is a remarkable coincidence that Mohammedan tradition speaks of locusts having dropped into the hands of Muhammad, bearing on their wings this inscription, "We are the army of the great God." The locusts of this first woe represent armies of men whose main force consisted of cavalry, invincible, licentious, and tormenting, analogous in their destructive operations to clouds of locusts. And so we're told there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. And unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. And so, having told us that the way in which they would come out of the earth and move forward would be like locusts, on the one hand they're locusts in the way in which they would form out, but also they can be described as scorpions. And this would be because of the nature of their sting, their deadly sting. So it was a combination of two symbols here. The scorpion is also a symbol of the Arab powers as well as representing their weapons of war. The bite or sting of the scorpion is generally fatal. Hence the power of the locust was a fatal power. They had scorpion-like tails, and in these tails was their power for destruction. The Saracen fire was used in instruments of war called scorpions, and this was the precursor of guns and gunpowder. So it has particular reference to the way in which they moved forward with their particular type of Saracen fire. We'll come back again to locusts because we're going to read something more about them in later verses. That note on page 101, of course, tells us a little bit about the effects that they have, the devastating effects they have on the foliage, which you might like to read at your leisure. So, we've got now the Arabs swarming up like locusts and with power like scorpions to sting. Now, verse 4 tells us what they were commanded not to do. It was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. That's why we said earlier on that their judgments were to be on the unsealed idolaters of the Catholic Empire. So first of all, they were told, do not hurt the grass, nor green things, nor trees. This represents people in general. People in general as distinct from those in particular who God singled out for punishment. So they weren't told just go out and destroy everybody. They were told to go out and destroy a particular class. Now when I say told, I'm using told in the apocalyptic sense, that God caused them to go out and do that. But it does actually go further than that, because there is on record a command which was given to the people as to what they should do, and it was quite specific. And it was, in the terms of the apocalypse, only those men who have not the seal of God. That is the Catholic idolaters. And it goes on record that the instructions which were given by Abu Bekr, the first caliph, to these bands of Saracens who followed him was significant. He said, and I'm reading from page 103 of the notes, "Remember that you are always in the presence of God, on the verge of death, in the assurance of judgment, and the hope of paradise. Avoid injustice and oppression, consult with your brethren, and study to preserve the law and confidence of your troops. When you fight the battles of the Lord, acquit yourselves like men, without turning your backs, but let not your victory be stained with the blood of women or children. Destroy no palm trees, nor burn any fields of corn. Cut down no fruit trees, nor do any mischief to cattle, only such as you kill to eat. When you make any covenant or article, stand to it, and be as good as your word. As you go on, you will find some religious persons who live retired in monasteries and propose for themselves to serve God that way. Let them alone and neither kill them nor destroy their monasteries. And you will find another sort of people that belong to the synagogue of Satan, who have shaven crowns. Be sure you cleave their skulls and give them no quarter till they either turn Mohammedans or pay tribute." Not quite sure exactly what was the distinction between those who lived in monasteries and those who didn't. I would have thought they were probably Catholics too. What he had in mind, though, I couldn't rightly say, but he certainly made no doubt about the fact that there were certain shaven-headed people answering to the Catholic priesthood, who he said that they were only given one chance: they either turned Mohammedan or else you could cleave their skull. And that's what happened. But as far as the grass and the green things, well, they were not to be touched. In other words, it wasn't people in general, but it was only a specific class of people. And that was the instructions which were given by Abu Bakr, answering so perfectly to Revelation 9 verse 4. So you see, we're not just looking at history, we're looking at the way in which God has seen fit to judge this power. And so down through the ages, people would be able to see these events and see the vindication of the judgments of God in such events as the Saracen hordes coming forward. Now we come on to the tormenting works which they were to do. Verse 5 says, "And it was given to them that they should not kill them, but that they should torment them 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when it striketh a man." So that this class of people, it's not talking about the fact that they wouldn't kill individuals, but it's talking about the system as a whole. Now the system as a whole was not to be killed. There would be individuals who would be killed in it, but the system was not to be killed, merely to be tormented. And the distinction between that and what happens under the sixth trumpet is this: that whilst the people would dearly have loved to have seen the empire just disappear and the Saracens come in and take over just to give them a bit of peace, that was not to be the case. They were going to torment them for two lots of period of 5 months. So it was given to them they should not kill them, but they should torment them 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Our first note tells us the empire was not to be entirely overthrown, not under the work of Jesus Christ, but that they were to be tormented for 5 months. 5 months is 150 days. 10 days a month, 150. This is the normal period, we are told, of locust activity. There are two periods of 150 days, or on the basis of a day for a year, 150 years mentioned in this particular chapter. The other one is in verse 10. So there were two lots of periods of 5 months, two lots of 150. Now, adding the 250 together, the two 150s together, we get a total period of 300. And this 300-year period answers to the total period from the death of Muhammad, when the first caliph was set up, in the year 632, to the year 932, which was the fall of the secular power of the caliph in Baghdad, which is generally recognized as the ending of the period of the caliphate, the successors of Muhammad. So it's rather significant that it was exactly 300 years, two lots of 150 years, answering to the period during which the caliph would have power to torment the eastern section of the empire. It was going to be for those who followed them to have the privilege of finally killing it. So for 150 plus 150, which equals 300 day years, from 632 to 932, dating from the death of Muhammad to the fall of the secular power of the caliph in Baghdad, that the tormenting by the scorpion-like locust would actually be carried out. I haven't said much about the aspect of the scorpion, but we've got an interesting note on the bottom of page 103, taken from 13 Lectures on the Apocalypse by Brother Robert. He comments that the Saracens employed in their military operations formidable missiles which they styled scorpions. I don't know what his authority for saying that is, but anyway, he said it, and I'm quoting him. An Arab writer speaks of them in 1249. And this is the Arab writer, as I say, that he's quoting. An Arab writer speaks of them in 1249 when he says the scorpions, surrounded and ignited by nitrated power, glide along like serpents with a humming noise, and when exploded they blaze brightly and they burn. Now to behold the matter expelled was as a cloud extended through the air, which gave forth a dreadful crash like thunder, vomiting fire on every side, and breaking down, burning, and reducing all things to ashes. Armed with this power, which was known as Saracen fire, and afterwards as Greek fire, because finally adopted by the Greeks, the Saracens had power to injure with scorpion power, but their mission did not extend beyond the infliction of torment. They were not to kill the Eastern Roman Empire in the way the Western had been killed by the Goths. They were only to injure it. The men of the Eastern or Greek third of the Roman Empire were to retain political life in the midst of their torment, but against the will of the majority, the bulk of the people were desirous for the sake of peace to submit to political death and accept the Saracen yoke. But death fled from them, because it was not in the divine purpose that the locusts should kill in the symbolic sense of the term, but only injure 5 months twice over. Compare verses 5 and 10. Why not 10 months instead of twice 5? Well, because locusts only appear 5 months in the year, and it would not have been in harmony with the natural history of the symbol to express it in any other way. We point out that Constantinople was twice besieged by the Saracens, but not taken. It occurred in the year 668 to 675 and 716 to 718. The locusts are described as tormenting the men of the Catholic apostasy in church and state for 5 months, and were also to injure them for 5 months. 5 months is 100, and all we've been through all this. That was summarised before, so I won't read it again. It goes through the two periods, the tormenting and the injuring, of 300 years, dating from 632 to 932. Now we're told in verse 7 I've actually covered verse 6 in my comments, although we haven't read it. In those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. The empire was not to die at this stage, but simply be tormented. Verse 7. And the shapes, or the resemblances of the locusts, were like to horses which had been prepared for war, and upon their heads as it were chaplets like to gold, and their faces as the faces of men. Everybody finished with that top sanctuary? Can I move it right off, that one? Anyone still want it left there? Can't work it out, Harold. Harold's trying to make people come in behind the glass, but I'll leave it there. Right. Let's solve that. That will be the remainder of the notes for tonight, so you might like to start writing, and I'll put them all up there and go through them piecemeal. So the first thing we're told was they were like unto horses. So they've first of all been likened, the hordes were described as locusts. They had a scorpion-like sting, but the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses. Now you see, we're not trying to picture some sort of physical, literal representation here. It's symbolic. And we've got to get used to this in a book like Revelation. You don't try to get a natural picture. It's a horde which is a locust-like horde with a scorpion-like sting, but it looks like a horse. Why a horse? Well, the horse was a symbol of battle, wasn't it? The horse was a symbol of Yahweh's judgment. So the locust represents the horde aspect, the scorpion is the sting, and the horse represents it is an animal for battle. The Muslim victories were largely dependent on their splendid cavalry. Well, that's another way of looking at it too. That's taking a fairly literal aspect, that they were certainly known for their cavalry, but I thought I had actually written something down there about the horse being a symbol of warfare. But anyway, it's implicit in that note. We go on to say that they wore crowns of gold. Actually, it's speaking about yellow turbans, chaplets like to gold. This is not to be confused with golden crowns used in other parts of the Bible. They were chaplets like to gold or yellow turbans. Note tells us that it was a resemblance. They were not actually literally golden chaplets, but they resembled golden chaplets. This would be they would be yellow so as to bear a resemblance to gold and signified the yellow headgear worn by the Saracens, so that they were light to gold. They weren't gold at all. They were yellow turbans, and again this represented the appearance of these hordes of Saracens. Another resemblance of the locusts was that they had faces as the faces of men. Now, this distinguished them from the Goths and other kindred barbarian hordes, the faces of these being shaven and smooth like women's faces. The imperial Roman custom was to have the beard shaven, but the locusts did not shave. They wore beards and so indicated their relationship to the bearded race and their antagonism to all shaven crowns. Sounds like Brother Thomas's words there. I think they were. We go on to verse 8. I'll keep reading fairly fast because it's 9:30. We're just about at the end of this section now, only two more verses to go. They had hair as the tresses of women, and their teeth were as lions. So again, we're getting several other symbols here which are not meant to be pictured in a literal sense. Their hair is the hair of women after the long flowing tresses of the Arabs, and their teeth were as lions. Well, lions are recognized in the scripture for their ferocity, teeth particularly being the aspect of the devouring, so their ferocity is described. So you build up a picture then of a swarming host like locusts with a sting like a scorpion. They are warriors because they're like horses. They wear yellow turbans. They look like men because they've got beards. They've got long hair like women, and they're vicious like the teeth of a lion. They've got breasts of iron. Some say that this was a description of their steel armour. I think also it would answer in the symbolic sense too to their fearlessness. Iron-breasted would signify, to my mind, fearlessness. But they tell me that they wore these steel cuirasses as well. Again, symbols which leave no doubt that it's speaking about these Arabs. And verse 10 introduces an interesting point, which says they had tails like scorpions. You'll find in Eureka and in 13 lectures that they describe there the way in which the Saracens would take these cannons, which we referred to earlier, into battle. They tow them along behind the horses, then when they get into position they swing around, and it was virtually out of the tails that these cannons would fire this Saracen fire, these cannons. So it was quite literally that the stings were in their tails. Of course, the scorpion sting is in its tail, but they say in the literal sense that when they went into battle, they had to swing around and sort of fire in a backward direction. So the scorpion sting is in its tail. It here signifies what came to be known as Saracen fire. 5 months, we previously noted that on verse 5. We come down then to the last verse of this section, which says, and they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. Now this king which they had over them is not the star. It's not the star of verse 1. He died a long time before this. He's not the star which opened the pit, but is rather to be taken as the official or head under which the Saracen locusts were organized after they had issued from the pit. He was apocalyptically named the angel or messenger of the abyss. Not the angel of the pit of the abyss, but of the abyss at large. So he was the representative of the whole of the thing, the whole of the empire. The historic parallel is found in the caliph of the Mohammedan system, who was styled the commanders of the faithful. This destroying power is called Abaddon in Hebrew and Apollyon in Greek, both of which signify the destroyer. It was given in these two languages because it was commissioned primarily and chiefly against the countries to which the Hebrew and Greek belonged. It was not set against Italy to torment the Italians. It was the Greek Empire, which included Palestine and Assyria, upon which the locusts were to fall with their most destructive energy. The death which the men of the apostasy so earnestly desired at length came in after time, and when it came, it reduced the men of the empire to the condition of mere dogs and slaves in the estimation of their Ottoman superiors. Well, with that, we just very briefly summarise what we've seen this evening. We're having a look then at the beginning of the judgments on that eastern section of the Roman Empire. God raised up a man by the name of Muhammad, who fled from Mecca to Medina. That gave him the opportunity to open up an area from which smoke would come forth, that is God's judgment in a general sense. But out of this smoke came locust-like hordes. These locusts had stings like scorpions, and they looked like horses. And so therein is described the Saracens, under the leadership of the various caliphs, who for 300 years, from 632 to 932, were to torment, but not to kill, the eastern section of the empire. The graphic description of them is found there in those verses where they are described as having faces like men, hair like women, steel breasts, turbans that look like gold, and so forth and so on. Their main purpose, though, was to ultimately destroy. They don't do it under the period of the fifth trumpet, but a subsequent power, which extends from them, does do it under the sixth trumpet. And so as verse 12 says, one woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. And God willing, we'll consider the next one in our next class.
We will bring this meeting to a close further and quickly by singing the words of hymn 198, followed by prayer. Hymn 198.